Thank you, Dr. Vandenhagen. Ladies and gentlemen, I offer you some succinct reflections on the necessity for dogmas in schooling. I'm much more eager to hear my colleagues here than I am to hear myself, so I shall be, I hope, to the point. Let me begin by saying that all societies live by dogmas, whether they be true and healthy dogmas or corrupt dogmas. And the decay of dogmas in our American society has something to do with the increasingly precarious state of freedom, as it has to do with the increasingly precarious state of order and justice. Several earlier speakers and commentators and members and guests raised the important question, or suggestion, that it would be well if we could make ourselves heard by starting a grand new Eastern daily paper or starting a new television network or something of the sort. And that would be very nice. I've been hearing that talk for 4 decades. Nothing happens. These are not new suggestions. I've also been hearing over these 4 decades the suggestion that we buy the New York Times. It's often made by gentlemen of great wealth. You're going to buy the New York Times. We have a conference on it, which I attend at my own expense. I find the conferences about buying the New York Times. And which these conferences, I say, I wonder what it is the vintner buys that's half so precious as the wares he sells. In short, the proprietors of the New York Times, the family that owns it, have a great deal of money. They even have more money than those who would like to buy it. They don't need more money. They don't have to sell. New York Times itself makes a great deal of money for them. They have other interests besides. They like influence. They like power. They are going to sell. And the men of great wealth who invited me say, well, everybody likes money. I say, well, you like it too much. You like it too much. You assume that others like it as much as you do. The family who owns the New York Times likes money. They also like power. And they're not going to give it up. You have to try other tactics. You don't buy out people who hold views opposed to your own. Over these 4 decades, I've known a great many men of great wealth, beginning with Henry Ford I. Very few of them can think. One reason they can't think is that they don't know the dogmas. They've forgotten the dogmas. You can't really think without dogmas to begin with, because dogmas are first principles. But I am a person who always likes to let cheerfulness break in. And we have heard some other suggestions today that, for instance, why can't we have films, television, and theaters that would try to restore an understanding of order and justice and freedom, and in particular, why can't we have a film about the Gulag Archipelago? Well, something even better than the latter suggestion is probably going to take place. My friend, Mr. Bruce Hirschenson, who, of course, under Mr. Shakespeare, was director of the USIA for films and television several years, a very talented man, is going to make a film based not upon the Gulag Archipelago, but upon the only screenplay which Solzhenitsyn ever wrote, which is about a concentration camp in Russia. Same theme as Gulag Archipelago, but written by Solzhenitsyn as a screenplay. All set, translated, has to be produced. And Mr. Hirschenson is working closely with Solzhenitsyn on the thing. The only thing that is lacking is money. And Mr. Hirschenson has to go about and try to scrape it up where he can through money brokers and various people who aren't interested really in Solzhenitsyn's beliefs or his faith or his courage. They're interested in one thing, that's money. And they see in Solzhenitsyn's name a chance to make more money for themselves, although they have a great deal already. They're quite indifferent to any cause. Here's a man who sold a lot of books and his name's in the papers, and he'll make money for them. And so research and so on, after various trials and tribulations and a lot of wandering around the country, we'll probably get the money to make a film, Solzhenitsyn's play. It'll be a very good film. He's a wonderful writer of screenplays. He knows all the techniques. It'll be a wonderful film when it comes out. The real Solzhenitsyn, too. And Mr. Hirschenson is dedicated to that cause. Before Mr. Hirschenson turns to that film, however, what he wants to do is to make a film of my book, The Roots of American Order. In fact, he's already written the screenplay, wonderful treatment. He's gone to Israel and Italy and Greece and Britain and has taken all the still photographs for it, and the screenplay's all written. I've worked it out with him. We have to find the money. I don't think we'll find it. It costs a great deal less to make my film than Solzhenitsyn, but the same money brokers don't expect to make money out of me that would make it out of Solzhenitsyn. I've known many men of great wealth. I don't know any who put up money for this enterprise. If it is put up at all, it'll be put by persons of modest wealth, independent proprietors, old-fashioned men of business who do it as a sacrifice and put up a few thousand dollars here and there, and if you find enough of them, I might collect it eventually, $350,000 to do it. Probably won't find enough. Certainly the great television networks would not sponsor such a thing, nor the Hollywood people. In fact, the people in Hollywood sincerely interested in seeing the film come out told me, well, we trust you can find, we're sure you can find the money in Michigan somewhere, because it'd be awfully hard to raise it in Hollywood. Well, you raise money for Hollywood in Michigan, backcountry Michigan, Wacosta County, Naked County, Wacosta. So some cheerfulness has broken in. At last, there is some talk about doing such things. Formerly, there wasn't even talk. The first steps were not taken. Well, one reason why we have this curious attitude of men of wealth and so many others in America is the decay of dogmas and schooling and elsewhere, the decay, in short, of understanding of any first principles of the person or of the republic. Now, this word dogma conjures up in the typical modern imagination the disagreeable image of the Holy Office and a pile of faggots who are going to burn the dissenters. The liberals have made it such. But that's not what our word dogma means. A dogma, or a plural dogmata, or dogmas, a dogma comes from the Greek root word meaning that which seems good. Sort of truth, something that seems true or good. That's what the Greek root of it, dogma, means. By definition, a dogma is a settled opinion, a principle, maxim, or tenet firmly established, or a principle or doctrine received on authority, as opposed to one based on experience or demonstration. In short, a dogma is a sound first principle you begin with, and you may, once you've accepted the first principle, you can learn something. You never know any dogmas, any first principles. You're all at sea all your life. That is true of a society also. You get nowhere. It's a life of disorder at best, perhaps of ruin, because you have no settled first principles. And so it is that any society which lasts subsists upon dogmas. As I say, they may be corrupt dogmas. Still, after a fashion, they will serve. That is Soviet Russia, Communist China. Necessarily depend upon dogmas, the dogmas of the savage god, if you will, and inverted Christian dogmas. Nevertheless, they are dogmas, and they are most rigorously enforced because that society could not function otherwise. Formerly, the society of the world society, or the Western society, of which we are a part, lived by Christian dogmas. And we still live by what is left of those dogmas in a secularized and often corrupted sense. In short, although liberalism professes to be anti-dogmatic, as a matter of fact, liberalism subsists upon a corrupt and vestigial form of Christian doctrine, which become merely sentimental and humanitarian. Nevertheless, its ideas are derived from Christian doctrine. We'll take a simple example. The endeavor through the civil rights movement and other means to bring the black people of America to a condition of equality. Now, the real dogma behind this is, of course, the Christian dogma of the brotherhood of man under the fatherhood of God. That's where the idea comes from. And this remains as a kind of residue or sentiment in the minds of the liberals. But then it becomes something else. And as they have dim memories of this dogma, they, however, secularize it and indeed corrupt it. But they still try to apply it after a fashion. And with them becomes the idea that, well, one man is as good as another, or maybe a little better. Or as it's put in Animal Farm, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. It's a corruption of the brother of the man under the fatherhood of God. I mentioned that merely to suggest that liberalism, too, must vanish when what's left of its dogmas vanishes and that therefore liberalism is now vanishing. And thus it is that Henry and Brooks Adams and George Santayana and others point out that liberalism has been merely an adventitious phase, a transitional stage, a kind of interlude between the old doctrines and dogmas and the era of the future, which will be dominated by squalid oligarchs, the rule of the savage god of ideology. Liberalism is indeed dissolving. It's already extinct throughout much of the world, decaying here, and decaying because the liberal really has nothing left to believe in. Having repudiated dogma, he is left with vague humanitarian sentiments, and those cannot withstand this power of the savage god. Well, so it is that dogmas, decay of dogma, obviously affects our education at every level. What was education formerly devoted to? What was it all about? Well, as Plato says, the ends of education are the acquiring of some measure of wisdom and virtue. And that was what schooling was all about for many centuries. A few persons mention wisdom and virtue in connection with schooling nowadays. It seems almost absurd, ridiculous to think you're going to get any wisdom or virtue out of school. At most, you can hope for a job. You probably aren't going to get that. Schooling exists for its own sake, to employ teachers, great apparatus, build buildings, erect an enormous federal empire of educational bureaucrats. That's what schooling's for. It has nothing to do with wisdom or virtue. It's a means of employment. And it has lost its dogma. Well, dogmas have vanished because, first of all, the diminishing of an ethical and cultural consensus, which would, of course, take a day to discuss in itself. But we all know, see signs of that, that shared belief has diminished among us of all kinds and faded along with dogma, and in part has been a cause of the fading of dogma. Feeling anything goes. So one thing, one belief as good as another. What is this shit that is shared after all? Will not indeed simply self-interest suffice. This has been decaying for a long time. It's decaying with the French Enlightenment. This decay was given additional impetus by Jeremy Bentham and his pals, and by many others in our own time. Shared values, shared beliefs, have diminished, and therefore their dogmas have decayed and their influence in schooling. More immediately, of course, a cause of the decay of dogma in schooling has been the virtual prohibition by our omniscient Supreme Court of any vestige of religious teaching in schools. Not that this court prohibited it altogether, but that school boards, frightened by certain of the court's decisions, proceeded to eliminate any remnant of reference to religious truth in the curriculum. Thus, with the disappearance of school prayer and reading the Bible aloud, any other vestige of dogmatic instruction, the schools abandoned the attempt, what was left of their attempt, to impart some kind of first principles about the moral order. That's gone from the public schools, not from all other schools, but has decayed and often in church-related and independent schools as well. Then along with these causes of the decay of dogmatic instruction of any kind, went, of course, the general loss of order and integration of knowledge. As colleges, as well as schools, became mere intellectual cafeterias, or perhaps anti-intellectual cafeterias, in which pushpin was viewed as good as poetry, or perhaps a good deal better, in which all subjects fell into a kind of degradation of democracy, and nothing mattered except it might enable you to, after you graduated, to join the country club, perhaps, or possibly to be certified as a potentially decent employee. As that attitude prevailed in education, as the whole idea of order and integration of knowledge went, dogma naturally was abandoned. The ethos of sociability triumphed in schools, so did vocationalism, and presently the counterculture in the past decade. And along with this came, finally, as a cause of the decay of any kind of dogmatic instruction, the typical teacher's dread of dogmata. When I talk on these topics, I'm an advisor, consultant to various educational foundations. When I talk on these topics to gatherings of public school teachers particularly, parents have raised the question of what is now called value instruction, usually a very feeble thing in itself. But the parents at least are alarmed at the decay of any kind of ethical instruction in schools and talk about teaching values When I take up such a topic, the great majority of the teachers, at least of the public school teachers, are immediately hostile. We're not going to be propagandists. We're not going to force our opinions on the students. They're here simply to form their own. We give them the facts, and they form their own. Thus, you give, a 7-year-old the facts about burglary. Is it better to be a burglar or to be the burgled? If you're the burgled, you work very hard and accumulate your property, and somebody breaks in the house and bashes you over the head and perhaps ravishes your wife and carries off your goods. Do you want to be that kind of person, or would you rather be the burglar who has all the fun and games? Choose for yourself. It's a matter of your own of your own judgment. It's obviously absurd, but that is the attitude of the typical public school teacher. I have no responsibility here. And back of the public school teachers, rejection of responsibility is this attitude: well, I really don't know what I'm supposed to teach. I don't believe in anything except salary raises, joining the union. I don't really believe in anything else, so how am I supposed to teach what I don't know? Then it lies back of it. They themselves have had no dogmatic instruction. They have no idea of enduring truths or values. They have at best vague humanitarian sympathies. Nothing they can impart. They are empty, vacuous. Not entirely their own fault. They themselves are the victims of the decay of the educational structure. Well, as I said, these are some of the causes of decay. Any society, as I've remarked, lives by dogmata. Because action must be founded upon certitudes. You and I can't act effectively unless we have some principle on which to act. I think here of a Sanskrit proverb. If you forsake a certainty and depend upon an uncertainty, you will lose both the certainty and the uncertainty. Forsake a certainty and act upon uncertainty, you'll lose both the certainty and the uncertainty. You have to have some kind of certitude, some kind of belief to begin with, to act at all. Otherwise, you are enfeebled before the ideologue, the devotee of the savage god, who, after all, does believe in something, evil though it is and deceived though he is. At least he can act, because he has some principle to act upon. The liberal of our times, the typical sort of person that Sidney Hook calls the ritualistic liberal, or Gordon Chalmers called the disintegrated liberal, that person has no principle for action, and therefore is defenseless against any threat. Well, we're corrupted, I think, in part by a misinterpretation, or at least too enthusiastic an acceptance of the dictum of Francis Bacon, in The Advancement of Learning. Phrase you all know. If a man will begin with certainties, says Bacon, he shall end in doubts. But if he will be content to begin with doubts, he shall end in certainties. That may be true for a brilliant man of science, like Bacon, like Einstein. But not for the average sensual man or woman, not for the average child. The average ignorant person cannot begin in doubt and somehow come by magic to certitude. Has to begin with some kind of knowledge which is conferred upon him by others who know more than he does, by the consensus, if you will, of the human race. To begin with certain pseudo-truths, then indeed he may be entitled to become a skeptic about some things, perhaps to discover something for himself, but he has to begin not with doubts, the average person, but with some certitudes to commence with. And these certitudes are what we call dogmata, things which civilized people have agreed upon for a long time. These dogmata may come from what we call revelation, and they may come from the insights of men of genius. They may come from the common experience of the race and trial and error, but they are the possession of civilized people, and upon those all true education necessarily is founded. There is, in short, a necessity for common belief. First of all, private judgment is insufficient for social coherence. That's an error in which the liberals fell there, and the libertarianism is, of course, merely a reductio ad absurdum of liberalism in this respect. The notion that private judgment will suffice and personal interest. I think there of the remark of Burke, who's been quoted earlier here. Burke says, the individual is foolish, but the species is wise. Individual is foolish, but the species is wise. And someone, when I quoted this recently, said, well, wouldn't that be a self-betraying or inconsistent remark? Because Burke was an individual, and so he must be saying that he was foolish. I always said, well, you're quite right. Burke did consider himself foolish. He might be wiser than his neighbors, but he considered himself foolish as an individual. And that he knew he would fall down into the ditch of unreason if he were not supported by, if you will, dogmata, by first principles, by the experience of the species, by the wisdom of the species. You recall also, of course, the aphorism of Benjamin Franklin. Experience is a hard master, but fools will have no other. And if you were thrown back upon your own personal experience, the little brief experience of our own individual lives, great folly is possible and indeed virtually certain. If you depend upon, however, the bank and capital of the ages, the accumulated experience, if you will, of the race, if you will, dogmata, then indeed you may be preserved and may indeed achieve something worth entering into the corpus of human knowledge. And thus, if ancient dogmata are forsaken, new dogmata eventually will have to be promulgated and enforced. Thus it is that the savage god lays down his own commandments. Thus, every terrible revolution, which has flouted and denied and violently overthrown the old dogmas, establishes almost at once its own dogmas, often the inversion of the previous dogmas, simply to maintain its existence. So in Russia, so in China, so in every land that's fallen victim to ideological conquest, new dogmas, the commandments of the savage god are promulgated and enforced most harshly and terribly. A society, having abandoned old principles, must have new at once, and conformity to those must be enforced by much less gentle means than was used in the old regime. And so we hear, indeed, among ourselves, talk here and there of democratic dogmas, liberal dogmas, vague attempts at this. Talk among, say, the friends of Theodore Bramald, the extreme votaries of John Dewey, of a religion of democracy with its own dogmas. That will be taught in the schools. The religion of democracy will teach everybody, the Mark Twain doctrine, that one man is as good as another, or maybe a little better. There's no difference among individuals. This will be the new religion. Democracy will take the place of God in abstraction. But these, of course, attempts are foolish because they are based upon ideological aspirations, slogans, not upon experience of reality, not upon the experience of the species or upon the truths of revelation or the insights of men of genius. Such feeble attempts at so-called liberal ideology or liberal dogma fail almost as soon as they are publicized. But there's another form, of course, of dogmatic activity in our time, decayed or corrupted dogmas, and that is the success of the fraudulent cults, of the moon cult, or Hare Krishna, or children of God, or of Scientology. We'll have any god but God. These exotic importations of a misunderstood mysticism, unrelated to our own civilization, which reject existing dogmata, even though they may copy it in certain respects, but which promise to the votaries who are themselves, the votaries are young people wretchedly educated in a typical school, promise them salvation through the new commandments, the new dogmata, which indeed, dogmata which had some meaning, say, in India, if you understand their context, the vast complexity of Indian religion and philosophy, but have no real meaning to the people who promulgate them in America, and still less to the poor dupes who embrace them. But this is an endeavor to, again, to create new dogma or conjure up exotic ones to do duty for the real dogmas, the dogmas of truth and experience, which have increasingly been forgotten and flouted in our culture. Well, since I've gone this far, I suppose I'm going to be asked, what do I mean that teaching dogmas in school? What am I talking about? I'm talking primarily of ethical dogmas about the nature of the person and the nature of reality. And in a sense, I had a dogmatic education. I went to a public school in Plymouth, Michigan. I was born almost literally in the railroad yards. I lived in a kind of railroad ghetto, went to Starkweather School in the lower town. So-called, both because of its geographical position and the status of its inhabitants. Good school. There was no instruction in religion. There was no school prayer. There was no reading of the Bible. We didn't have any of those things. Nevertheless, there was a kind of imparting of dogma. What dogma? Well, Christian dogma. What branch of Christianity? Well, I suppose a kind of vague blend of Methodism and the Baptist doctrine. That was what prevailed in the town of Plymouth, Michigan in those days. No one ever mentioned creeds in school. But these dogmas had permeated the education and the life of the teachers, and they imparted them quite unconsciously, without much any effort to the students. And that sort of dogma, accepted formally without challenge in America, after all, did keep American society going, as Tocqueville and others have pointed out. It could have been better done, but it sufficed, at least half a century ago. And to get an idea of what sort of ethical dogmas the teachers thus imparted in their rather vague and unintentional way, well, we'll turn to a book which many of you here have read, C.S. Lewis, The Abolition of Man. And you recall there, perhaps, at the end of that book, the appendix, which Lewis calls the Tao, T-A-O, the Tao, borrowing a word from Oriental religion and philosophy, the way, the path. They taught, in short, the kind of natural law which Lewis discerns in all civilizations, a certain dogma about human existence. And you may recall that Lewis lists eight major laws, or dogmata, which he has various subdivisions. And he lists among these things which are taught, have always been taught in all real cultures, real civilized countries, these general principles or dogmata, these foundations. He lists the following, eight of them. First, the law of general beneficence. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. Second, the law of special beneficence, duty toward individuals connected with us. Third, the duties to parents, elders, and ancestors. Fourth, duties to children and posterity. Fifth, the law of justice, substance to each his own. Sixth, the law of good faith and veracity. Seventh, the law of mercy. And eighth, the law of magnanimity, or generosity. These were, after all, imparted in my little school in Plymouth, Michigan. I imbibed them, told everybody else. And after a fashion, they sufficed. They are no longer imparted very well in many schools. Mostly, I suppose, they're not really imparted at all. They were imparted in my time through the study of literature, study of social studies, or civics, as we called it then, and all kinds, in the sciences, in all kinds of ways. These are things taken for granted. They permeated the teaching. We didn't have to have a special course in them. There wasn't a course in ethics or in logic, anything of the sort. It's just that these suffused the curriculum. And as Philip Phoenix of Teachers College says, still can be done. The curriculum should be suffused with veneration, reverence. Still can be done. It isn't necessary to amend the Constitution. And as Philip Phoenix says, if we indeed believe that there must be a wall of separation between church and state, between the order of the soul and the order of society, then he says that wall will separate two tombs in which church and state, soul and society, decay separately. This is the present wisdom of Teachers College Columbia, a good deal different from what it was some decades ago. Well, in certain America, we have lived by certain social dogmas, as well as ethical dogmas, by dogmas about the dignity of man, about representative government, about the tension of order and freedom, about a humane and free economy. These formula were taught almost unconsciously in schools, and they sufficed us to keep together a good society, about as good a society probably as the world has ever known. These things are no longer taught dogmatically, or perhaps at all, in most schools, the dignity of man, a true understanding of representative government, a true understanding, if an understanding at all, of the tension between order and freedom. Teaching about a humane and free economy is highly inferior, or perhaps it's a teaching about, a quite false teaching about an economy. These things, these dogmata of the civil and social order have wretchedly decayed in our instruction. Similarly, our college and university education is generally in a bent condition nowadays from a false understanding of academic freedom and a false understanding of what a university is all about. And it is a university is assumed to be a great intellectual cafeteria, as I suggested, where all ideas and notions are in equality, all subjects are equal, and there is no place at all for dogma, because you've supposed to have gotten rid of that in kindergarten, if not before. There are no enduring principles. And when I had a debate some years ago with a very distinguished scholar at Harvard, he was debating on academic freedom, and he said, well, I agree with most of what Dr. Kirk says about academic freedom in his book, but I can't agree with his remarks on truth in university. He said, what truth is there in the university? In fact, he said, what is truth? The words of Pilate, of course. What is truth? And I pointed to the motto of Harvard, which happened to be hanging on the wall, Veritas, truth. That's what Harvard's supposed to be all about. It had been quite forgotten by a distinguished professor. What is truth? It would not stay for an answer. That's what I mean by the decay of dogma in college and university. I don't mean that university and college ought to be places for indoctrination in a political sense or ideological sense. It ought to be places where healthy skepticism should be developed, where foolish notions should be challenged, where, indeed, independence of mind should be cherished and advanced, but not through the deliberate breaking down of first principles. When I was in the staff at Michigan State, some of my colleagues in sociology and education and psychology got up a very ingenious device which was administered compulsorily to all entering freshmen and 4 years later to the same students when they graduated as graduating seniors. This was to determine whether our basic college was doing its work. And there were 100 questions, some with various parts, carefully drawn up by my colleagues. And they were to test the opinions or prejudices of the entering freshmen and learn how they'd been enlightened 4 years later. And they were all questions designed to break down dogmata. Here's an example. The question is, do you believe that if to have a thing done well, you must do it yourself? Now, they knew that a good many students, unfortunately, were coming with the old-fashioned prejudice that this is true, that if they want a thing done well, you must do it yourself. But the aim of the college was to enlighten them, so that by the time they graduated as seniors, they would know, and of course know, it should be done by a committee, if you want it done well. You know how beautifully college committees function. There's this question. Do you believe it is wrong for brother and sister to have sexual intercourse? Now, I don't suppose that my colleagues were in favor of incest on principle. It was just a thought, this is an old-fashioned dogma, it ought to be challenged. You should enter college with an open mind, and if you at least don't have an open mind entering the college, when you graduate, at least you say, well, it's all right for you for that, if that's what you want. It's a matter of personal choice. You're free, you know, libertarian society and all that. Go ahead. It's up to you. Don't abide by any dogma in these matters of sexual relationships. Well, they gave this great test to all the entering freshmen. They ought to take it, and the same people took the test 4 years later, and guess what happened? There was hideous chagrin among my colleagues because they all held the same opinions it held in the first place. The university had failed in its mission. In short, dogmata still have power. It's still possible they may resist even the intellectuals of our time. There's a certain health still in the American public, diminishing, no doubt. The university's been at work since, but there's still a little health there. And perhaps the intellectual feebleness of most of my colleagues is not altogether a bad thing. At least it tends to diminish the corruption of the students who are in their charge. There is, in short, freedom under dogma. There cannot be freedom without dogma, because without dogma you cannot act. Freedom and action is necessary for the realization of freedom. We ought to clear ourselves of these silly slogans about keeping an open mind. A mind which is perpetually open means one through which every wind of doctrine can blow, blows in one ear and out the other. I like a filled mind. Rather than open mind, filled with both fact and just conviction, with belief, with faith, the sort of mind that Solzhenitsyn has, a filled mind, because the open mind, if it's always open, is an empty mind, a vacuum. Also, I think we ought to stop this silly talk about the university being a marketplace of ideas. For at the devil's booth, all things are sold. It's not a marketplace of ideas, it's a place for the pursuit of truth. Truth is never very easy to capture. Nobody captures truth entirely, but at least you're supposed to be pursuing truth. It's not a place for you to chaffer, you sell off one idea for another. They're all equal, they're all a matter of mere commodities. What a false analogy. The marketplace of ideas. Marketplaces are all very well for articles of commerce, not for truth. The truth is not bought and sold. It's painfully labored after, laboriously pursued, can't be bought. Can't be sold. It's not in the marketplace. Well, I'm saying that only those of firm convictions maintain their freedom, just as the priests and the communists in the German concentration camps. Only they resisted the terrorism of their captors because they believed in something. They didn't have open minds. The Catholic priests and the communist agents, they had, in short, dogmata to adhere to. And that saved them. No one else was saved because they didn't have dogma. A few others were. So I conclude with a summary of dogma by a great poet, often laughed at, of course, by the liberals, reviving in reputation in our time, Rudyard Kipling. And I understand that my colleague, Mr. Davenport, is going to have a further quotation from Kipling for you presently. This is a poem that many of you don't, but probably some don't. It's a favorite of Mr. Regnery's, who inserted it in one of the anthologies he published. The Gods, the copybook headings. This is the best summary of Dogma that I know. Rudyard Kipling, 1919, just to the end of the Great War, as it was called. We are to imagine that he's the narrator of this poem is a kind of Hindu spirit, or avatar, really, who passes through various incarnations in looking at the world. As I pass through my incarnations, in every age and race, I make my proper prostrations to the gods of the marketplace. Peering through reverent fingers, I watch them flourish and fall, and the gods, the copybook headings, I notice, outlast them all. We were living in trees when they met us. They showed us each in turn, these are the gods, the copybook headings, they showed us each in turn that water would certainly wet us, as fire would certainly burn. But we found them lacking in uplift, vision, and breadth of mind. So we left them to teach the gorillas while we followed the march of mankind. We moved as the spirit listed. They never altered their pace, being neither cloud nor windborne like the gods of the marketplace. But they always caught up with our progress, and presently word would come that a tribe had been wiped off its ice field, or the lights had gone out in Rome. With the hopes that our world is built on, they were utterly out of touch. They denied that the moon was Stilton. They denied she was even Dutch. They denied that wishes were horses. They denied that a pig has wings. So we worship the gods of the marketplace who promised these beautiful things. When the Cambrian measures were forming, the gods of the marketplace, they promised perpetual peace. They swore, if we gave them our weapons, that the wars of the tribes would cease. But when we disarmed, they sold us and delivered us bound to our foe. And the gods, the copybook heading, said, "Stick to the devil, you know." On the first Firminian sandstones, we were promised the fuller life, which started by loving our neighbor and ended by loving his wife. To the women had no more children, and the men lost reason and faith. And the gods of the copybook headings said, "The wages of sin is death." In the Carboniferous epoch, we were promised abundance for all by robbing selected Peter to pay for a collected Paul. But though we had plenty of money, there was nothing our money could buy. And the gods of the copybook headings said, "If you don't work, you die." Then the gods of the market tumbled, and their smooth-tongued wizards withdrew, and the hearts of the meanest were humbled, and began to believe it was true, that all is not gold that glitters, and two make four. And the gods, the copybook headings, limped up to explain it once more. As it was in the future, it was at the birth of man, as it will be in the future, it was at the birth of man, that there are only four things certain since social progress began. That the dog returns to his vomit, and the sow returns to her mire, and the burnt fool's bandaged finger goes wobbling back to the fire. And that after all this is accomplished, and the brave new world begins, when all men are paid for existing, and no man must pay for his sins, as surely as water will wet us, as surely as fire will burn, the gods, the copybook headings, with terror and slaughter return.